Hey everybody, welcome back to Dental Unfiltered. I'm Matthew Brown. I'm here again with Dr. Andrew Vallow. We have a really exciting, fun episode for you today. You guys were nice enough to give us some really awesome questions, and Andrew has picked roughly five that I think are really interesting ones. They're awesome. And we're going to address them one by one and answer your questions that you guys posed to us. This is an exciting episode for us. We were excited for when we had enough listeners to have questions. And now that we do, I think this will be a once every now and then thing that we do because there's always more questions. And, you know, you guys are always welcome to DM us and send us questions. If we have free time to answer them, we will. If not, we'll make sure they make it on the show if possible. So I'm going to start off with the first question for Dr. Vallow. Actually, first, Dr. Vallow, how's your week going first? Have you opened up? Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks, Matt. What's up, guys? Week's been interesting. So we opened my two newest startups, not this week, but last week. So I've been busy with that stuff. I also have my associate doc in my flagship office is in Dubai for a dental conference / wedding this week. So I'm spending a little bit more chair time than normal. So it's been a little chaotic. I had an email account hacked. I had one of my credit card accounts hacked. So I've been dealing with that too. So there's always a million little things going on behind the scenes. That said, I am pumped for this episode, and I want to give a shout out to Glenn Vo, head of Nifty Thrifty Dentist. So Matt and I had the honor of hosting a panel at Glenn's PodFest conference that he hosted a couple weeks ago. And Glenn had this awesome idea of, hey, why don't you guys do a listener question episode? And thank you to the listeners that sent in these questions, man. These are some really, really great questions, and I'm excited to dive into them with you guys today.
Yeah, Glenn was awesome. That was a great event. I thoroughly enjoyed it. We pulled questions.
Yeah, he's a great dude.
It was the first time spending time with him. He's amazing, dude. It was a great event. The panel was fun. I met a lot of really cool people. Dr. Hendrik Lay. I mean, there's so many really good people there to meet. Desmond, it was awesome. So
yeah,
all right, I have a little bit of cold. I apologize to you guys if I'm sniffling a little bit. Question number one, and this is something that's totally outside of my realm, so I'm really looking forward to Andrew's answer. Can you talk digital sensors and IT setup? I have no idea about it, about the IT part of dentistry. So Andrew, I hear these questions a lot when I'm dealing with new startup owners, and they start asking me these questions. I make sure to always yield an area that I'm not familiar with. I'm looking forward to your knowledge on this. So IT is one thing, and then there's medical sensors or imaging sensors on the other side that are digital. The marriage of those, it seems like there's two different groups that kind of put those together. So why don't you explain, you know, digital sensors and IT and kind of the challenges of it and what works?
Yeah. So, you know, guys, I love technology. You know, we've got iTero scanners. We've got CBCTs. You know, we've got all the different TVs hooked up to the computers and things like that. I just don't know how technology works. So like that's not my niche. So like everything else, I'm big on hiring professionals to do the job for you rather than trying to DIY everything. One, you just don't have the time, but you know, two, as a business owner, your time's very valuable. So, you know, what I could spend a whole, you know, week trying to figure out and still not do right, you know, I can hire a great IT company to do in a single day. And so that's what I've always done. I did find a great IT company. I use one out of South Florida. They're called Cyber Dental. They've done my IT build out for all four of my practices. Really, really great. The guy's a great owner. The team's really great too. So that's kind of how we set up our IT. You know, we have a server in the office, so we didn't go cloud-based. You know, we use Open Dental. We do have three TVs in each op. So the bottom one is hooked up to our TVs. They were, you know, run some low voltage wiring and everything. And that way we're able to slide like pictures and images and scans from the computer over to that 50-inch TV right in front of the patient's face. They set up our, you know, in-ceiling speaker system. Basically, anytime we have an issue with anything, they come out and they take care of it, or they remote in and take care of it for us. They got me set up on my laptop, so I'm remoted into all the different office computers so that I can get in. And, you know, I live almost an hour away from the newest startups, but I'm able to just remote in right now and add a patient to the schedule or check on the schedule or, you know, check a patient's chart or, you know, whatever it is. So that's really helpful too. As far as the sensors go, I decided to use Dentamax sensors. I vetted, you know, I looked at some different Facebook groups. I talked to a few companies. I looked at some pricing. Dentamax offers very competitive pricing for their sensors. And the quality has been very solid. So I have no issues with it. My associates don't complain about them. I'm able to diagnose properly from the sensors. And they're significantly less than some of the major name brand sensors that you could buy. So We use Dentamax sensors. We also got our imaging software through Dentamax. It's called DentaView. I think it's produced by like Planet DDS, but it's sold through Dentamax. So again, a pretty cost-effective option that still has very good results for our imaging there. And that would be my recommendation. If you haven't looked into them yet, check them out. You know, nothing against the high-end, you know, major name brand sensors, but you're going to pay about double for those sensors what I paid for Dentamax. So.
Yeah, I think there's also something like with that kind of stuff, I find with technology in dental is there's like effective and then expensive, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a balance that has to be maintained when you're buying this stuff of like, you think that you can only do the best dentistry if you have the best stuff. And really, this comes from my special ops background. It's not the equipment, it's the human, right? Like, so if you have a human that's awesome, an awesome dentist, you don't have to buy the, I mean, like, it's just ancillary stuff that kind of supports the dentist. It isn't the magic. The magic is the dentist. So, you know,
No, man, you're hitting it on the head. And I think there's certain things that differ with that. So like, you know, we've talked about chairs before. I have Series 5 DCI chairs. Like, yes, I've bought a lot of them at this point for my 4 startups. So we get pretty good discounts, but still, even at full price, you're paying a lot less than the ADEC chairs. They look great. They function great. I've had no issues with any of them. We get this really nice gold ultra leather, you know, upgrade on them that doesn't cost a fortune, but it looks like a super nice fancy chair. And we save thousands and thousands of dollars doing those DCI chairs versus the ADEC chairs. I will tell you what, Matt, I don't think I would do a dollar more in dentistry if I had the ADEC chairs instead of the DCI chair. So that's kind of where my brain goes. And I feel like it's the same way with the sensors. Like, yes, you need solid quality because you need to be able to diagnose properly from the X-ray sensors. If you're just using some generic sensor that you buy on eBay or, you know, you buy from some just foreign company and it's crap and you can't see anything on it, then that's a different story because you're going to be missing diagnosis
that's
everywhere.
I mean,
it's not effective. Exactly. It's not effective. Yeah. But, you know, as long as you have a solid sensor, you know, the difference between this and again, one of those major name brands that cost double the price, I don't think the quality difference is very much. I don't think I'm really missing anything with diagnosis. And I still saved a lot of money with the sensor. So the things where it varies in my mind are things like the iTero scanner. And there's a pretty heated debate. There's some docs out there that really hate iTero, hate the company Align, you know, feel like they monopolize dentists, you know, with their pricing and how they make you use all of their stuff, their scanner, their product. I disagree. I mean, for me, I do understand where they're coming from, but for me, Invisalign has just been such an amazing part of our practices. You know, at this point, again, we're diamond providers. My flagship office, we did 40 Invisalign starts in December. In January, we did 39. In February, we're going to be close there. And then in March, we're doing an Invisalign party. We're probably going to have a record shattering March at this point. So yes, the iTero scanner is pretty expensive compared to some of the other options out there, but it turns ROI. It makes it so much easier for me to offer this service that we're doing a lot of and has been a huge production boost for our practice.
Yeah, so. And to go back to that, the whole attack on the line, I mean, Ferrari is the supreme of supercars, right? And if you want a Ferrari, you have to have, you know, in your Ferrari dealership, you have the Ferrari diagnostic tools, Ferrari everything. That is an area where if you want the Halo product and you want the traffic from a Halo product, the Halo product company is going to require to use the best stuff to maintain the quality of that Halo product. That's really what's going on there.
Yep.
And I find the docs that attack these things are grumpy, underachieving docs that want to blame everything else on their non-success. And my docs that are plentiful mindset, that are doing great, that are profitable, never complain about the same stuff. It's like a different complaint field completely. So that's just my view on
that. I don't want to throw those docs under the bus. I mean, I get it. But, you know, just again, if you really take that abundance mindset, you can start seeing some things differently. Just whenever you're evaluating a buying decision and you're looking at, you know, two vastly different costs, ask yourself, how much more dentistry am I going to do with a more expensive product versus a less expensive product? If it's a chair and the amount of dentistry is zero difference, you probably want to go with the more affordable, cost-effective option. Thank you, listener. Question number one. If you have any follow-up questions from my answer there, feel free to shoot me another email.
We're moving on to question
Let's go on to question number two.
It was really funny though, real quick. I saw a lady, a female dentist, who posted on Facebook recently that like upgraded to ADEC chairs, selling these chairs. And in my head, I was like, why? What was the difference? I believe in practicality and effectiveness, not prestige and name. So number two, This one's really cool, and I want to hear your answer about it. I have something to add to this one. Solo associate, have never been able to collect more than $480,000 a year, doing bread and butter dentistry with high insurance collection. Owner restores implants and offers clear crack. Office and network with Delta and Cigna. Hygienist booked out 7 to 8 months. What are your keys to increase my production in this scenario? I want to hear your answer first.
Yeah, and I think I remember that question. They had two hygienists at that practice. Yeah, so good question. I will give you just kind of a scenario of my flagship office. It's kind of a similar setup in the sense that there's one, you know, main associate. I'm the owner doc. I'm only practicing 2 days a week. So, you know, that probably helps my associate out a little bit, but he's there 4 days a week. You know, average monthly collections over 100,000. So, I mean, you know, he's going to do 1 point some million this year in collections. Does bread and butter dentistry, does a little bit of surgery as well. We're a very heavy PPO office. So, I mean, you know, we accept basically every PPO under the sun. We're in network, even Delta Dental that has really low reimbursements. I think some of the keys for us, you know, one is that we did negotiate our insurance fees other than Delta that doesn't negotiate. So most of our insurances pay us very well. Another key is just new patient flow. I mean, you know, we had months where you're seeing 250 new patients a month. And when we needed that, you know, we could do it. Even now, we're typically seeing over 100 new patients a month. So I don't know what the new patient flow is like there. But if, you know, I guess with hygiene booked out, you may not be seeing enough new patients. You may need to look at ways to fit in more new patients into the schedule. We used to only bring new patients in through hygiene. And then once hygiene started to fill with the recall schedule, I realized we couldn't get enough new patients in anymore. New patients are really important to your practice. Like guys, like even if you've got a well-established practice, you've got to be getting new patients in to continue to grow. So we started bringing new patients in the doctor's side. Now we'll bring them in on either side. It just kind of depends on where the opening is. But that's allowed us to see a lot more new patients, even with our recall schedule pretty full. We stopped offering the cleaning at the first visit. So we used to do that. I got a lot of pushback from my team on that. They thought there's going to be major issues. We've had a couple patients that were maybe a little frustrated about it, but you know, for the most part, we explain why we do it. We want to give them enough time at that first visit to really welcome them to the practice, to do a full proper diagnosis, to give them enough time talking with the doctor. We don't want to rush through either the exam diagnosis portion or the cleaning portion. When we try to combine them both in one visit, it kind of makes everything rushed. So what we do is we do the exam portion first, then we bring them back for their cleaning. They get a lot more time at the practice. We don't charge them any more for it. So we're actually bringing more value for the same price. When we explain things that way to patients, most reasonable people understand and actually appreciate that. And it allows us to, you know, bring in more new patients, bring in patients on the doctor's side as new patients. So that would be my first question is like, what's your new patient flow look like? Can you guys get in more new patients? With you being booked out so far in hygiene, you may need to look at bringing them in on the doctor's side. Other thing is we do a lot of same-day dentistry. That's huge. So if you're not trying to do same-day dentistry wherever possible and you start doing that, you know, anytime we have a conversation with a patient, if they have treatment that needs done, even if the schedule's pretty full that day, I mean, we can almost always work it in. We're properly staffed. We, you know, we've got enough assistants that can, you know, help out in different rooms. You know, we're good at our time management. So, you know, that's something I've always coached my associates on is like, hey, you've got to know what room you've got to go into next. You've got to know when to numb a patient. You've got to know how long to tell the patient to expect the numbing is going to take. There's all kinds of little tips that go into that. But if you're effective with time management and you can flip more same day dentistry, that's a huge cheat code to increase your production. You know, you said you're doing bread and butter dentistry. The owner does clear correct. It may be worth you looking into that. You know, as we mentioned earlier in this episode, we're huge Invisalign practice. I prefer Invisalign. That's just me. I think the product works very, very well. But clear correct, you know, clear aligners, kind of same idea. If you're not doing them already, go take some training, start doing clear aligners. That's a huge way to add some really, really quick, big production to your day just by closing a clear aligner case. I personally don't place implants. So, you know, I've had months when I've been in my practice without any associates where I was producing over $200,000 a month, not placing implants. So, you know, bread and butter dentistry, some cosmetics with veneers, some Invisalign. But you know, you may want to look at adding to your procedure mix. Yeah, I think that's a great starting point, Matt. What other thoughts do you have for this listener?
I'm thinking about the human side for him. One thing I don't know is how long has he been an associate for, right? Is he new associate? He's been associate for 5 or 6 years. what's his relationship with the owner doc? Is the owner doc there to mentor and invest in him and help allow him to do more complicated procedures if he gets the proper training and the proper CE? Or is the owner doc literally trying to hold him to, you just do bread and butter and that's what your purpose is? And if it is, maybe it's time to consider a change. And maybe it's time to, you know, get out on your own to feel more clinically fulfilled. One thing is, you know, we can say all day long, like, you know, increase your patient flow, but he's not the owner doc. You know, he's the associate. So he's in a cage. He's on a leash where he has to, hopefully the owner doc wants to give him more patients, right? One thing I'm curious about is he does 480 a year. I'm curious what total collections in the practice is. Is it 1.5 and he's getting one third of it and the doc's taking the majority of the good stuff? That's the top part of the collections. I don't know the mix, you know what I mean? And where there is avenue to grow, because he is really restricted when you're an associate. You're kind of locked in this cage and you're kind of placed there based on what the ambitions are of the owner doc, right? I've had owner docs where they don't mind turning through an associate every couple of years as long as they don't eat into their implant work. I've had other owner docs that are like, I really want to foster this guy and keep him because I want to go from 3 or 4 days a week down to 1 day a week and have an associate that can do work and I can do less dentistry. I don't know the relationship is there. I think for him, my one question is, how long have you been an associate? If it's a year, hey, you still got time. As far as I know, I have docs though that have opened up practices a year out of school and done really well. They're kind of outliers, right? If you've been there 4 or 5 or 6 years and you're feeling constricted, you're feeling like you're not clinically fulfilled, and you're feeling like there's no room for growth for you, you might have to create your own room for growth and go to a startup or go buy a practice. It might be time. I don't know the scenarios, but just thinking about the human side of it, that's my opinion.
Well, and those are some great points, Matt. And, you know, I will add, not everyone wants to be an owner. So, you know, if you've been at this job for 4 or 5 years and you feel like the owner's restricting, you know, your production potential, and he's not interested or he or she's not interested in, you know, changing that, maybe look for another associate opportunity. You know, I don't want to tell everyone out there, go on a practice, because I know it's not for everyone. There's a lot of stress, a lot of work. I mean, I've been pulling like 14-hour days almost every day lately, trying to keep up with everything. So, I mean, it's not, you know, as glorified as we may make it seem sometimes. So, you know, hey, if you just want to be an associate, there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe this just isn't the right fit for you. You know, the thing I will say is, I think a lot of it comes back to that abundance scarcity mindset and what the owner's thought, you know, or what the owner's mindset is. If it's an abundance mindset owner, I mean, they should want their associate to get as much production as possible. That's what I want. You know, if we're both there on the same day, I would rather his schedule be full, my schedule have holes in it, because I know I have stuff I could be doing. You know, if I'm not seeing patients, I could be working on a million other things I need to catch up on, whereas the associate's going to be in the office twiddling his thumbs. So I always try to preferentially fill my associate's schedule before my schedule. You know, as an owner, if you're not doing that, if your schedule's packed and your associate's light, that associate's probably not going to be around a long time, and you probably have the wrong mindset. You know, I have owners that'll say like, oh, well, you know, I can't afford to take the production loss. I brought on an associate to, you know, increase my take-home pay. And, you know, my feedback is like, one, long-term it should, you know, but there's like an ugly duckling.
Doesn't happen month
one. There's an ugly duckling phase. You have to go in and you have to be okay with decreasing your take-home pay for a period of time. Yeah, maybe even a year. I mean, it may take a while, but it's all about the long-term and what you want. Like, do you want more time? Do you want more flexibility? Do you want to grow your practice, grow your equity? If so, great, bring on an associate. But just realize that you're probably going to have to take a cut in your own take-home pay for a while, and that's okay. And, you know, if the owner's answer is, I can't afford to take a cut in my take-home pay, then you shouldn't be taking on an associate right now. It's kind of like the same idea. Like, if you can't afford a tip, you probably shouldn't be going out to dinner. That's my thought process with an owner bringing on an associate. You have to go into it eyes wide open, realizing they're going to cut into your production, at least for a period of time. They're going to cut into your take-home pay, at least for a period of time. And in the long run, it's going to benefit you. But in the short run, you've got to be okay with taking that.
It's really hard to find significant short-term benefit anyway in any area of business, right? And I had a thought, and we'll move on to the next question here 1 second. He called me literally a couple weeks ago, long-term client. And he goes, hey, Matt, I got an associate starting the first of next month. I need to ramp things up to be ready for him. Bro, we should have been talking about this 3 months ago. And he's like, really? I'm like, this is 3 weeks away. And the doc's theory is that he's at, let's say for round numbers, he's at 100K in collections. if I add an associate, that'll go to 150. No, it's not the way it's going to happen. It's going to eat into your 100. And I would love to know how you feel about this. I don't think below 150, any doc needs an associate. I think there's a threshold here of like, if you want to have the buffer and the operating capital and everything to properly implement an associate, I think the threshold is 150 or above, depending on your product mix. But when it comes to your operating capital margins and everything else, if you try to do it 100 to go to 150, that's really bad. If you're at 150 and you want to do less and give him part of that 50 and try to grow to 175 or 200, that's the right mentality. I just feel like they think that like that person's going to add 50K a month on. No, they're going to eat into part of it.
Yeah, no, I agree, Matt. I mean, I think I was right around maybe a little above that 150 mark when we brought in our associate. But honestly, I didn't need an associate at that point. I brought one on earlier than I needed one because I wanted my practice to continue to grow. And I was okay with cutting into my own production. But at that point in time, you know, I was able to manage the practice by myself. And like I said, we had months that were well over 200, but, you know, average was maybe 175 at that point. We brought in an associate. Now, that was over a year and a half ago. Since that point, you know, our practice has grown to the point where now lately we've been averaging like 300K a month. So, I mean, like that having an associate has allowed us to grow, but it didn't happen month one, month two, month three. I mean, it happened over the course of time as we continued to grow our practice. So,
yeah. All right. Next question. This one's actually really cool. All right. How do you systematically handle employee performance reviews and raises? Currently, it's by the seat of my pants. That's not good. And employees will come to me randomly asking for raises. That's never going to end. So they're always going to ask for raises, right? So Andrew, I would love to hear your view on this. I'm actually a new practice owner. I just bought a practice recently and we're starting to work on structuring all this right now. So I'd love to hear your question and I kind of would love to put my two cents in. So how do you measure performance and how do you handle that?
No, that's a good question. Honestly, it's something I've been working on trying to improve our systems because I was that doc. I mean, things were totally by the seat of our pants for the first year and a half, 2 years. We've been implementing some more systems lately, especially with newer hires. I will say the things I think we've done well is we pay competitive base pay for our area. So, you know, it's like, hey, I want our teams to come in. I want them to work hard. I want them to have great attitudes. I want them to, you know, feel comfortable with the compensation that they're receiving. But beyond that, we offer some great bonus opportunities. So, you know, it's like, hey, if the practice is meeting our objectives, they're going to get bonus on top of their base pay. And that's kind of a win-win because it keeps our whole team motivated to flip same day production, to close Invisalign cases, you know, to hit goals, to keep overhead low, while at the same time, it also rewards them with these bonus opportunities. So, you know, on top of a pretty competitive base pay, they're also making bonus pay most months. And so between those two things, I mean, I think it's helped prevent the need for, you know, frequent raises on the team. That said, I give raises based on performance and not based on longevity. So just because someone's been with my practice for a year or 2 years, you know, or whatever it is, doesn't mean that they're going to automatically get a raise. So I give raises often preemptively before the employee even asks for one because of the performance I've been seeing. And so, you know, our employees that are rock star performers, they've gotten raises for the most part without even asking for them because I say, hey, you're doing a killer job. I really appreciate the value that you're bringing to our practice. So, you know, you're getting a raise and you know, it's typically a small raise. Because once again, the real opportunity for them to increase their compensation is to increase the practice's performance, the practice's production, and then they're going to take more home. So that's kind of our system. Now, that said, I have started to implement some tiered pay for some new employees with like assistants in particular. So we've got like four tiers of assistants. I took that from my mastermind group from DSI. So that's something we're trying to implement into the practice, where it's like basically there's different skill sections for each tier. Once you cross off those skill sections, you go into the next tier and this is what this tier is paid at. So that is something we're trying to transition to in the practice right now.
I think the key is the problem with flying by your seat of your pants is no one likes the fear of the unknown, especially when it comes to their money. And you may be indirectly causing staff anxieties by not having a clear way that they rise. And what that does is that's going to create a scenario where staff start to seek other clearer paths for upward momentum financially in the form of other jobs. So one thing I'll tell you is for sure, seat of your pants is never a good idea. Second, make sure you set clear targets and show them the path they have to walk down. And if they achieve it and they perceive they achieve it, don't try to find your own interpretation of it to not pay it. That drives everyone nuts.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. I spent time in Andrew's practices, West Chase, the flagship office. It's probably top two atmosphere, most positive environments I've been in dental. I mean, the entire staff is ready to hop in and do work and do, like, literally every team member's attitude is whatever it takes is going to happen today to achieve, because they have a clear path and they know what their target is for bonuses, and Andrew gives it to them. He doesn't find ways not to. So you have to invest in your staff. You have to stop seating your pants now, because think about it. If you didn't know, if you were flying in the unknown of how you could increase your money, that would cause you anxiety because you don't really know how you can do it. And then what you're going to do is you're going to go seek someplace else. That will have to create a massive staff retention problem. So I believe a really clear target, really clear path to get there, and during the reviews, measure it.
Add on this idea. And, you know, there's also some heated discussion on bonuses. There's some consultants that really don't believe in bonuses. I'm of the opposite camp. I'm a big incentive guy. I would like to keep everyone motivated. I like to reward the team when, you know, performances are hit. The way that I think about it, and the way that you guys should think about it, you know, in your own practice, think about being an associate dentist. You know, I was an associate dentist in a public health setting where I was on a salary. My salary was set no matter how many patients I saw, no matter how much dentistry I did, I received the same compensation. And there was no bonuses for hitting certain objectives or anything like that. I was a younger dentist. I was a newer dentist. It was a good transition. I believe I was doing good dentistry, taking care of my patients. But I'll tell you what, I was not motivated to quote unquote flip same day dentistry to fit more dentistry in the schedule, to stay late to do more dentistry, versus when I was an associate in a practice where I was making a percentage of my production. You better believe that I was doing everything I could to fit more dentistry in my schedule. So if that's how we think as associate dentists, imagine how your whole team thinks. You know, do you think your treatment coordinator is motivated to flip that same day treatment at the end of the day when everyone's ready to go home if there's no incentive to closing that treatment? So, you know, if you're not offering any bonus systems in your office right now, in my opinion, you're missing out on a huge opportunity to really keep your team incentivized, to have your team take that ownership mentality where they care just as much as you do about getting more production on your schedule. So that's just my take there. And you know, I think that's good feedback for any of the listeners that aren't currently applying any bonus systems.
The only thing I can talk about is my experience. On Dental Intel, across their 9,000 practices, our population outperforms. We do 2.75 million a year compared to the average of 1.1 million a year across our practices. I'll tell you that my most successful practices have bonuses. It is. So I agree with Andrew. I think that every person on the planet is motivated by two things, time and money. If you increase the quality of their time and pay them more, you're going to achieve more. So that's just my opinion. I think anybody that's like, oh, I don't agree with bonuses in dental, is still thinking like 1980s, 1970s dentistry. They need to modernize a little bit. I'm going to move on to the next question. This one's really good. I'm a lead dentist for Aspen. I've been offered a buy-in opportunity. Seems like it could be a good move financially, but I've always had the dream of owning my own practice. The landscape of doing a startup seems challenging, and I feel like buying in Aspen may just be easier. What are your thoughts on my situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I may have to start off by admitting I'm a little bit biased here, having done four startups in the last 3 years myself. Yes, the landscape can be challenging. What'd you say?
I think the startup's easier, but that's just me. I would rather do a startup than an acquisition.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily easier, but I think if in your mind you want to own your own practice, that's what you should do. I don't think buying into a DSO is going to feel nearly the same. Not to mention, you're not going to build the same equity that you can. Think about what it costs to open a startup. You know, let's just call it $600K. And then think about if you really grow that practice. I mean, if you grow it to the point where it's doing 2 million, 2.5 million, 3 million, you know, even more, that equity has shot up, like skyrocketed, versus buying into a DSO, you know, practice. Your opportunity for increasing equity is not nearly the same. You're never going to have true autonomy. You're never going to have true ownership of that practice. And again, it's not the right fit for everyone. So, you know, if you had said, hey, I have this opportunity, I don't think I really want to take on the challenges of true practice ownership, that may be a good hybrid option for you. So I'm not saying it's a bad move necessarily. I'm just saying if you're the type of person that you know you wanted to own your own practice, then I don't think that's probably the right move for you. As far as the startup landscape being challenging, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of stress. You have to have the right mindset. You've got to have that abundance mindset, knowing that if you invest in the right things, your practice is going to grow. But guys, I'm in a competitive area. When people hear what I've done and they hear our numbers,
extremely competitive.
They literally, the first response I get often from people is like, oh, you're somewhere rural, aren't you? No, I'm in Tampa, Florida. Like, there are 10 dentists on every corner. I've got tons of competition. I've got multiple dentists within a mile radius that have over 1,000 Google reviews like we do. So, I mean, there is no lack of competition here. Yet I was able to navigate that landscape to do 4 different startup offices, and they've all been successful. Every single one. I mean, the new one's just started, so I guess this is a prediction, but based on our first couple of weeks, I have no doubt. Every single one does over $1 million in our first year. Guys, it is absolutely 100% possible to be successful in a startup. You've got to do the work. You've got to be willing to make that, you know, your first priority while you're in that growth phase, while you're in that build phase, that grind phase. You've got to put the work in. You've got to have the right mindset. You've got to have the abundance mindset. You've got to be willing to spend money you feel like you don't have. You've got to spend money to make money, guys. You've got to invest money in marketing. I think the number one failure of startup dentists is failure to invest in marketing for their startup and just expecting that people are going to show up to their practice. It doesn't happen, guys. Yeah. People aren't just going to walk in your doors and all of a sudden your schedule is going to be full. You have to invest in good marketing to get patients in the door. My new startups, we're spending first month like 12 to 15K per office, and that's going to continue. My very first startup, I spent about 5K a month, and I wish in hindsight I would have spent more. But it's like, you know, even at that time, it's scary to spend a lot of money when you don't really know, like, you've got no patients, you've got no revenue coming in.
I think I remember
you don't feel like you have the money.
Spend more at one point early, and you're like,
It's possible. But I mean, even me at 5K was more than a lot. I mean, I kid you guys not. I talked to dentists that tell me they're spending $500 on Google Ads.
It's a waste.
Oh, yeah, I'm spending $500.
You're throwing away money. You're making a donation to Google. Thank you. If you're spending that little bit of money, just don't stop. To waste.
And they tell me that's all I can afford to spend with my budget. And I'm like, well, you're going to have no budget pretty soon if that's all you're spending, because you're going to have no patients and no revenue. Guys, as a startup practice, like, you have to spend, like, I'm saying minimum 5K. I was able to grow, and I was maybe a little fortunate, and I was working very hard, and I was grinding, and I was hustling, and I was ground. I was doing everything I possibly could to fill the schedule at 5K a month. I wouldn't even recommend that. Guys, take out the extra loan money. Market budget that you're going to have at least 10K a month to spend on marketing. At least those first couple months, start building the schedule. You don't have to do that forever. You know, my flagship office, you know, we're probably down to like between 7 and 10K a month, but you know, we're still trying to grow quickly. You know, even at the production clip we're doing, but in your early going as a startup, guys, you have to spend that money on marketing in order to get patients in the door. And I know we've went on a little bit of a rant here. So getting back to the question, what should Dr. Aspen do here? I think it all comes down to what your goals are. If your goal is truly practice ownership, I think you should pass on the opportunity at Aspen, and you should look for an acquisition or a startup practice. Just go into it realizing there's going to be a period that's a little scary. There's going to be a period where you have to work really hard and put a lot of hours into your practice. And you may decrease your take. You probably will decrease your take home pay for an amount of time, whether that's a year, 2 years, whatever it is. But if you have the right mindset and you invest in the right things, your potential earnings down the road, your potential equity down the road is far greater with your own ownership versus buying into a DSL.
So. I have something for Dr. Aspen too. You know, Doc, part of this is having confidence, right? So what I find is I help a lot of startups. I help a lot of acquisitions. In the startup, the painful part is the leading up to opening. In acquisition, the easy part is when you sign paperwork to buy it, 'cause that's all you do. And the hard part comes, and the painful part comes when you're changing culture and trying to impose your vision on those patients and those humans in the form of staff. So you have two different difficulties that start on different phases. I find the startup part, as long as you have a plentiful mindset and you spend on marketing, the painful part goes away and it gets actually a lot better after you open. The other side is when the acquisition's harder after you get possession, because it's just you're navigating the human terrain, you're alienating people. One thing for Dr. Aspen is Aspen Dental is like the trenches, warfare, front lines of dentistry. If you've survived Aspen Dental for any length of time, you should be pretty confident, because you can definitely last owning your own practice, whether it's a startup or an acquisition. Some of my best docs come from Aspen and Affordable Dentures. And if you can survive in those two organizations for more than a couple of years, you have the ability to really dig in, and you have the dental intestinal fortitude and the grit to own your own practice. If you really want to do it. So listen, I'll do an initial consultation meeting with a doc who's buying a practice or doing a startup. And I'm like, where have you been working? And they'll be like, Aspen Dental. I'm like, how was it? Like, it was so hard. Never saw the same patient twice. Policy's changing all the time. It sucked. Like, hey man, you're going to thrive owning your own practice. So what you just went through was like the Navy SEAL training of dental. No BS. Like, I look at guys that like I have a guy who comes to mind right now, Dr. R.T. Torres, USA Dental in Florida. He was at Aspen for a long time. And dude, that guy was like, he hit the ground running so fast doing his startup, because what he just came from was so hard. Listen, if you're Aspen or Affordable Dentures or one of these giant corporate companies, and you've spent 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years there and you've thrived, you should have a high level of confidence in betting on yourself for opening a practice, because you did the hardest form of dentistry, in my opinion. That's just my thought.
Dude, I really love that point, Matt. And I couldn't agree with you more. I've found the same thing, man. Like, my stud associates typically come from corporate environments like Aspen. And I'm not saying to discourage those that haven't worked for a DSO, but I am saying I think if you have worked for a DSO where you're in this fast paced environment with all these, you know, crazy things going on, and you're going to be better prepared to open a startup practice and thrive on your own than someone who's worked in like a slower private practice has. So everyone has their opinions about DSOs. I think these large DSOs, they have a place. It's a great way to get great training as a younger dentist to, you know, increase your speed and efficiency, to learn new procedures,
to develop hand skills,
to develop time management skills. Yeah. That's one of the biggest struggles that I've seen in associates who haven't worked at a place like Aspen, is they may do great dentistry, but they struggle with time management and being able to know when to go between different operatories, when to numb that patient, when to go do exams. Whereas my docs that have worked at places like Aspen, they're, you know, studs at it. They know absolutely how to handle those situations. So I agree with you, Matt. I think Dr. Aspen being a lead dentist at Aspen Dental, if they want to go out and do their own thing, I think they'll absolutely crush it. So that's our nod of confidence to you. If you want to go own your practice, man, go do it. I think you're gonna do even better than you could possibly imagine.
And Dr. Aspen, if you're listening to this and you want to have a conversation, private message me on Facebook. I'm in all the groups. It's Matthew Brown. It's a picture. I think one of my military pictures, my profile picture. Private message me. I'd love to have a conversation with you about it. I think generally, whenever a doc from Aspen says I want to do a startup or own a practice, I'm like, yes. Like, I mean, you should. You've developed. You developed in probably the worst environment you could, so therefore you can thrive in any environment. So. And Aspen's a great organization for the most part. It's just, it is hard dentistry. So we're going to move on to question number 5. This one's one I was actually really excited about. I own a practice with 4 associates, 14 ops, that produces about $6.5 million a year. Sounds great, but the problem is it's netting nothing. I literally broke even last year. I've had multiple practice consultants take a look. Seems like problem is new patient flow. We average 60, 70 new patients a month. When I first started the practice, we had 100 NPs a month and plenty of profit. I need to know where and how to spend marketing dollars to increase new patient flow. I need immediate help as I'm thinking of selling out to a DSO if I can't solve this soon. All right. So
yes,
this question could almost be its own show, to be honest. So
it could be.
It really could be.
We can always revisit it later if we want to.
This question could be its own, honestly. So there's two things I see either in super practices or in multiple practice ownership. In multiple practice ownership, we end up having maybe four practices with two practices worth of collections spread across them, right? Or we get super practice ownership where we overscale labor and some other stuff and drown ourselves. Like, I think it's this scenario. Andrew, I'd love to hear your view as somebody who's built now four practices. And I think your four practices will be over that 6.5 million area per year easily. So
we're projecting 7.5 this year, but
about that question.
And yeah, what's your advice? So I love this question, man. And I feel for this owner and I want to help you out. I'm going to follow up and send you an email back too, but I want to talk a little bit about it on the show. Thank you for, you know, being open. Thank you for being vulnerable.
Yeah, that's really vulnerable.
Yes. I agree with the consultants that new patient flow sounds like it's a problem. However, I don't think it's the problem. The production that you're doing for four docs, 14 ops, you know, could you be doing more production? Sure. But do I think that there's enough production there to have a profitable practice with, you know, I guess I don't know the full breakdown of your team, but do I think there's enough production there for four docs to have a profitable practice? Yeah, I think so. So I think the bigger problem for you right now is your overhead. I think that there's areas on your overhead that are in the red that you're spending way too much money on. And I think the number one thing you need to do is you need to take a close look, a deep dive at every single item on your P&L sheet. And you need to see, what am I spending on this? What is the industry average percentage wise? And, you know, where am I over? You know, like, for instance, your supplies, you know, for my office, we shoot to stay around 2-3% for supplies. And it's very possible. And I look and I see P&Ls from other practices where they're spending 8% on supplies. That's a huge difference right there. So just, if you find a couple of these categories where you realize, like, man, we are way overspending, and maybe it's, you know, you need to join some buying groups if you're not part of them. Maybe you need to get somebody else on top of the supply ordering. Maybe you're ordering too much supplies. Maybe you're ordering the wrong supplies. Maybe you're ordering from the wrong source, or you're paying too much for the supplies. And I'm not saying it's the supplies. I'm just saying, as an example, there are probably things on your P&L that you are spending more money, probably significantly more money than you need to. And just by doing that deep dive and turning a few knobs, you can probably go from netting zero to all of a sudden, hey, now your EBITDA is at 10%. And 10% EBITDA, you know, maybe it's not what we're shooting for, but on 6.5 million, that's 650K. It's not too bad. Now, do I think you can get to 20 or 25% EBITDA? I do. It's probably going to take a longer road to get there. And you know, there's going to be more in-depth things you need to do. But I strongly imagine that there is a low-hanging fruit there of a few things that you can make some changes. And all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of dollars in profit are going to come flowing back into your practice. So that's my first thought. If you're not already part of a mastermind group like Dental Success Institute, I highly, highly recommend looking into that. So, you know, that's who taught me all about overhead, who taught me about industry standards for what percentage you should be spending on different items, at looking at the P&L in depth. I mean, they basically have a whole system set up on belts, and Matt got all giddy over this, you know, over the jiu-jitsu belts and training and all that stuff. But so if you don't know Dr. Mark Costas, you know, he's like the biggest name in dentistry and dental podcasting. He's the founder of this mastermind group, DSI, and he is all about your numbers. He's all about EBITDA, profitability, overhead. You get belt categories based on things like what your overhead percentage is. You know, we're shooting, you know, anyone in that group, we're shooting to have overheads under 50%. So if you think about some simple math, guys, if you have, let's say you have an overhead of 50%, industry standard for paying doctors, including the owner doctor, is 30%. That's average, that's standard. So let's say you got 50% overhead, 30% that you're paying to your docs. That leaves 20% on the table for EBITDA. And in all actuality, it's actually higher than that because you've also got hygiene production coming in. So unless you're one of those weird practices like my implant office where we have no hygiene, you probably have hygienists at your practice. The doctor's not making a percentage of that hygiene pay. So, you know, if your overhead's 50% and you're paying your doc, because overhead is everything except doctor pay, basically. So if overhead's 50%, you're paying your doctors 30%, they're actually not getting 30% of the full production. They're getting 30% of the doctor production. You know, maybe it's coming out to 27% or, you know, whatever it is. So your EBITDA is actually probably into the low to mid 20s at that point in time. So anyways, getting back to it, if you haven't worked with a group or a consultant that really took a deep dive with your overhead and looked at areas that you need to tweak, that's the first thing I would do. You can do that on your own. I mean, I'm not telling you that you have to hire someone to do that, but I'm telling you it's been very helpful for me to be in a mastermind group where, I mean, every time we meet, we have these hot seats where, you know, each of us gets 20 to 25 minutes to talk about what's going on in our practice. The first thing we have to go over is, what's your overhead this last month? What's your overhead this last year? What areas are you spending too much on? I mean, we get a whole spreadsheet where areas are green or red based on, you know, where we're at spending for that category. So I think that is the number one problem you're facing right now. Now, to get back to your raised point about new patients, yes, for four associate docs and a $6.5 million practice, I do think 60 to 70 new patients a month is fairly low. You know, as I mentioned at my flagship office, when we were 1.5 docs, we were doing about 2 million at that point. We were averaging 250 new patients a month. So I do think you want to get your new patient flow up. I do think you want to take a look at marketing. And the crazy thing is, while I'm telling you to reduce your spend in most areas, because I think you're overspending on things, you may actually need to bump up marketing a little bit, or maybe you are spending enough on marketing, but you're doing the wrong type of marketing. Maybe you need to fire your marketing agency and find a new one. What's worked well for me consistently over the last 3 years for all of my practices has been a mix of strong emphasis on Facebook ads, the ones where potential patients send you a message. They're messaging your office's Facebook page. Instagram ads, kind of doing the same thing, messaging the Instagram page. And Google. Facebook and Instagram have been probably 80% of the spend, whereas Google's been about 20% of the spend. There's advantages and disadvantages to both. But if you want a very high volume of new patients, you're going to get much better bang for your buck with Facebook and Instagram ads than you are with Google ads, just because Google ads are more expensive per new patient acquisition. So for somebody like you that maybe does need like 200 new patients a month or 150 new patients a month, I would definitely look into doing those things. Just to give you some insight on what I'm able to accomplish with these ads. This is kind of funny. So talk about losing stomach lining as a startup practice owner. We had a bunch of construction delays. We were delayed over 6 months. My contractor is probably the most dishonest human I've ever met in my life. He's number one on my most hated list. And I didn't believe a word he said. So like it was very tough for me to plan when we were actually going to open our doors. So what I did is I kept holding off on launching the marketing and scheduling because I didn't want to spend a bunch of money, get a bunch of patients scheduled, then find out that we couldn't open yet. And from having done this a few times, I knew how quickly I could fill a schedule. So I started my first marketing and scheduling for both of my new startups exactly 1 week before they opened. 1 week. We had zero patients on the schedule. We saw 71 new patients that first week. So in 1 week of marketing and scheduling, we were able to put 71 new patients on the schedule.
So
marketing works, guys. Yeah, you just have to do the right marketing.
Yeah, you have to find the right marketer. So I want to add to this. There's a couple things that worry me about Doc's scenario. So you're doing $6.5 million a year production. You're only bringing in 60 to 70 new patients a month. My first worry is the mouths in your practice are devaluing. So what happens is that $6.5 million isn't sustainable because you don't have enough new mouths coming into the practice. So if you do all the crowns in mouth one and there's all there is maintenance left, now that's not going to be available next year. So the first thing that's going to happen is because your new patient flow isn't high enough, there's not enough production in the existing patient base to sustain that. So you're going to start going backwards here soon. And if you're at break even, that might be the pendulum of the backwards slide, right? A second problem is, are you allowing the staff to dictate your scaling strategy? So a lot of times what happens is you start scaling and adding docs, and office manager says, well, we need 3 assistants per doc. Let's go hire 3 assistants right now. And all of a sudden, you're always scaling your staff. Your staff has to understand that the things we do on a daily procedural basis to do 1 million in production is different than 2 million. And as we grow, we have to change what we do every day and become more efficient. Processes have to change all the time. I have a feeling that your systems and processes for 2 million is what you're doing at 6.5 million. And if you looked and refined all that, you probably could come down even on staff. And you know what happens is the doc should dictate the scaling strategy and inspire the staff to be more impactful with less resources. Because if every time you add on more, the staff says we have to double our staff footprint, you're never going to grow your EBITDA, right? So don't allow the staff to dictate the scaling strategy. You dictate the scaling strategy and give the staff the processes to be successful doing it. I think those two things, if you did that and added in, you have to add in better marketing to increase that new patient flow, because you are probably starting to backslide on the value of the mouths in the practice. I would love to turn on DI in that account and actually look at true average patient value and look at what's there for production for the future, because we can figure out exactly what your opportunity level is for next year by doing that. So selling to the DSO with you breaking even last year.
Don't do it.
I wouldn't do it. Don't do it. Like, because you're not going to get it. What's going to happen is you're going to take a chunk of money, and one of your buddies that has a $2 million practice is going to sell in a few months. He's going to tell you his chunk of money, and it's going to be 3 times bigger than yours. And you're going to be like, his practice is a third smaller. You're going to cry.
Yeah.
Fix your problems. But I'm telling you, they're the two things I would caution against. Don't let your staff dictate strategy, and you have to increase new patient flow. You have to.
You just stole my next point, but thank you for saying that, man. Don't sell to this DSO. That was going to be my concluding remarks to you. So for those of you that don't know, DSOs typically value practices based on a multiple of EBITDA or profit. You know, we were just talking about how this practice has no profit. Now that said, even though the practice has no profit, doesn't mean the DSO is going to be like, well, we can't give you anything because there's no profit. I'm sure, you know, savvy DSOs are like, hey, this is a freaking diamond in the rough.
Oh, that's a great opportunity for the DSO.
They're going to steal it. Way underpay you for this practice. Like, seriously underpay you for this practice. So DSOs love big practices. They love practices that are doing a lot of revenue and a lot of EBITDA. So let's go back to this equation. And I don't know what if you shop this, if DSOs have made you offers, but let's just take some numbers, you know, into account here. Let's say you were doing 10% profit, 10% EBITDA, which again isn't great. I think it's something you could very quickly get to here. A practice that size, even at 10% EBITDA, you know, you might get like an 8x multiple on that. 10% EBITDA, 650,000. Times 10x, you know, that's 4.8 million, something like that.
No, 5 million. Okay. Times either 10x. Is it 10x or 8x?
No, I said 8x.
Is it 10 would be 6.
Yeah. They're probably not getting 10x at 10% EBITDA. But let's say you got this to 20% EBITDA, which is a healthy, strong EBITDA margin. I personally know dentists who have had EBITDA margins as high as like the low 40%.
I got docs that are in the 30s.
Insane. 25 is great. 20 is good. I think you could definitely get to 20 within a year or two of working on some stuff here. So let's say you got to 20% EBITDA. That's 1.3 million in EBITDA. At that point, with that size practice, that size EBITDA, you might be able to command that full 10x multiple on that EBITDA on 1.3 million. Now you're talking 13 million. So practice valuations can very, very quickly escalate, multiply exponentially as your profit margin goes up. So if you were to sell this practice with zero profit to a DSO, and unfortunately with how much money the practice is bringing in, DSO is probably your buyer at this point. But if you're going to sell, you're selling
individual docs, not buying it.
You are selling this practice, and when it's absolutely as least valuable as possible to the DSO, they're not going to give you anywhere near what the practice is worth. If you could just work on the profitability for a couple of years and get it up to a healthy profit margin, I mean, you're talking about, you know, eight figures of value for this practice. I mean, that would be life-changing money there. So don't give up yet. I will follow up with an email. I want to see if I can help you out here. I think you've built an incredible practice. There's just some things that probably need to be tweaked. So,
yeah. All right.
I think that's a wrap, right, Matt?
Yeah, that was our last question. Those were great questions. We're going to do this periodically throughout the year, guys. Those questions are really awesome. Thank you so much for them. For you guys that were admitting some issues of, you know, inadequacies or some issues of underperforming, thanks for the vulnerability of willing to share and talk to us about it. We're going to close it off here. You know, guys, thanks for listening. It's been enjoyable. It's been awesome to meet some of you at dental events these past few weeks. If you got to meet us, it was really cool. Dr. Vallow, do you have anything to close with before we sign off?
Man, this might have been one of my favorite episodes yet. This was really fun, Matt. Thank you to everyone who sent us questions. If you want to be considered for the next listener episode, I don't know when it's going to be, but as Matt said, we'll probably do these periodically. Send me an email. It's Doc, D-O-C, Vallow, my last name, V as in Victor, A-L-L-O. dds@gmail.com. So send me an email with your question. Everyone today was anonymous. If you want a shout out on the show and you don't care about your name being said, we're happy to say your name and give you a shout out as well. But just let me know if you want to be anonymous with your question. I'm going to keep a folder of any questions that come in over the next, you know, month or two here. And then when we've got a nice collection, we'll release another episode about from listeners. Other thing, guys, if you're enjoying the podcast, please, please, please just take a minute, leave us a review, share with friends, share with fellow dentists. It's been awesome, the support we've received, you know, in the early goings of this podcast. Again, guys, keep in mind, we have no sponsors. We're getting paid nothing for this podcast. We're just trying to bring you guys valuable content, and we appreciate you guys helping us grow. So thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys. Have a wonderful day.